Good evening. I have two brief stories to tell you before my reading, both highly relevant to our homage this evening. Incidentally, am I audible? Yes? A little too? A little louder. In the early 1950s, as a new immigrant, I worked as a clerk, I've never decided which, in this august institution at its grand 42nd Street branch, in the acquisitions department. Simultaneously and secretly, I wrote my first play at my desk in the intervals when acquisition work grew slack. My pay was $50 a week. Much to my pleasure, I was proposed as a candidate by its curator, a delightful southern lady, to be assistant in the remarkable Arendt's tobacco collection. This was, and still is, an impressive amassment of books and manuscripts from many ages and sources, assembled by a gentleman called Arendt's, who I assumed had made a large fortune in tobacco, because the one indispensable condition of their being purchased by him for the collection was that they somewhere mentioned that now suspect commodity, or at least the smoking of it. The delightful curator, by way of preparation for my meeting with Mr. Arendt's, who was coming especially to town that afternoon to inspect possible candidates, took me into the securely guarded sanctum, kept religiously at an even cool temperature, and proudly showed me the impressive filing cabinets of card indexes. Opening one quite at random, my eye fell immediately on a card clearly reading Wilde, Oscar, followed by a title, The Importance of Being Earnest, a play in four acts. Being a bit of a show-off, as well as anxious to display any fragment of acquaintance with literature that I possessed, I said airily, "Well, one thing is a little wrong there, surely. The importance is actually in three acts, not four." "Oh, do you really think so?" the curator replied, even more airily. Then opened a drawer and took out several school exercise books and passed them to me. These constituted the complete original manuscript in Oscar's own handwriting, each volume an act. And they were four in number. They had been bought by Mr. Arendt's entirely because of the scene in the play in which Mr. Worthing confesses to Lady Bracknell that he smokes. And she replies, "I am pleased to hear it. A young man must have an occupation of some kind." In palpitating astonishment, I sank down, if not on my knees as Rossini did on being shown the manuscript of Mozart's Don Giovanni, then at least onto a library chair, and devoured the whole piece throughout one unforgettable lunch hour, turning the very pages that he had turned. And as I did, the truth emerged clearly that he had been right to cut so many of them. My impression was clearly that the extra material, playing with church matters and the affair between Miss Prism and Canon Chasuble, can on the whole be dispensed with to the evident improvement of the whole. Its reduction to a three-act shape endowed it with the unprecedented effulgence we all adore today. As I closed the book, there appeared in the doorway the figure of Mr. Arendt's himself, a severe and canny-looking old man sitting in a wheelchair staring at me with, unless my imagination is now supplying them, a pair of disapproving eyes. Pointing to the corridor, he called out to me imperiously, "Wheel me," and I obeyed, pushing him out of the room and along that broad, polished floor of the 42nd Street building. My memory also provides him with a shawl around his shoulders and the sort of cackling voice used by Joseph Cotton to play the aged wheelchair Jedediah in the nursing home in Citizen Kane. This was an important moment for me. If I succeeded in gaining the job, I would be able to increase my salary from $50 to $60 at least. Leaning over the chair as I pushed it, I asked into his ear, as concernedly and sycophantically as I could, "Excuse me, sir, I was wondering if there is a Gutenberg Bible in your splendid collection." The cackly voice snapped back at me, "No, young man, there is not. There happens to be no mention of tobacco in the Holy Scriptures." Alas for me, I don't know why, but I couldn't stop myself. In a desperate attempt to appear witty, I demanded, "Well, what about the Book of Psalms? He toucheth the mountains and makes them smoke." To this idiocy, Mr. Ahrens replied nothing at all, but only indicated with a peremptory and mottled hand that our interview was over, and that I should push him back swiftly to his collection room and away from any further contact with myself. My second story occurred many years later, in the mid-90s, when I was approached by a lady called Susie Bassani, a tremendous theater enthusiast living in Dayton, Ohio. She and a group of like-minded ladies had all by themselves set about raising an enormous sum of money to restore a large, derelict, but nobly ornate 19th century theater, once called the Victoria, in the heart of their city. They had raised, in fact, some $16 million, renovated it, refurbished it, regilded it, and rechristened it the Victory. And it was a victory indeed over malignant city planning and mindless demolition. "Would I please," Ms. Bassani asked, "come and open it for them at a great initial gala evening and speak the first words from its splendid new stage, preferably by Shakespeare. They also wanted to know if I had any ideas for what the rest of the evening might consist of." I called back, accepting with delight, and suggested that Ms. Bassani should appoint a little team of eager student researchers to discover what things had actually been played in the old theater during its 100-odd years of earlier life. She loved this idea, found the researchers, and between them, they proceeded to dig up all sorts of rarities and wonders. The comedy that Lincoln had been watching on the night he was killed, Our American Cousin, had been played there, and we had a scene from that. A tragedy by Booth called Brutus had played there, and we had a scene from that. Sarah Bernhardt had acted there in Phaedra, and Zoe Caldwell gave us an impression of that in, of course, Racine's great French. And Splendor of Splendor, Oscar Wilde, on May the 2nd, 1882, had lectured there on aesthetics to an enthralled, and I suspect partially bemused, audience of Midwesterners, wearing shoulder-length hair, a jacket of wine-red velvet, and perhaps holding a lily. I called Dayton immediately and asked if anyone could send me a copy of what he had actually said, and asked if, instead of just declaiming "All the world's a stage" at the opening, I might also be allowed to play Oscar. And this was granted. I supplied the wine red velvet, and they supplied the lily. I'm sure I didn't make a convincing Oscar. Missing, of course, was the Anglo-Irish drawl that I imagine he had. And of course, it was hard to achieve the right self-mocking air of affectation. Also missing, naturally, was what must have been the transfixing element in his presence that turned something apparently like condescension into irresistible charm. The fact is that the man clearly charmed multitudes. One must never forget that he was a master of beguiling excess. He once wrote, "Nothing succeeds like excess." And the 19th century flocked to the theater for just that quality. They sought excessive performance not only in plays and operas, but in sermons, lectures, political orations in public assemblies, and dramatic recitations in private drawing rooms. Everybody, of course, took part in amateur theatricals. And as always, Wilde was delightedly in touch with what was, and I actually believe still is, popular taste. I mean a taste which is not much interested in the minimalism and unshowiness which is so held in esteem now in some intellectual circles concerned with the theater. In a word, Wilde could do nothing that wasn't in some clear sense theatrical. This said, it has to be admitted that when I first read it, the Dayton lecture seemed a little muted. and perhaps too much concerned in places with thoughts on fabrics and the aesthetics of homemaking. I was, I confess, glad that I only had 5 minutes to deliver a taste of it, sandwiched in, as I was, between excerpts from many plays in an evening lasting over 3.5 hours, and actually concluding with a finale from an American turn-of-the-century jamboree which involved, I'm not exaggerating, 500 boy and girl scouts and 2 elephants. My job was obviously to select its most entertaining observations, and I decided also, since this was in effect a miniature job of playmaking, to include in the text a few succulent lines from other similar lectures which he had delivered in nearby towns or spoken elsewhere, whether in salons or saloons. My contribution was largely limited to linking passages. All the rest, I submit, is vintage wild. One thing I'm certain of, I'm sure he would always look benignly on any attempt by a playwright to entertain in his spirit to his glory. Listen now, please, to his voice in its most light-hearted vein, always flecked with seriousness, and rejoice with me that such a spirit lived amongst us and left us to us his glittering work. Incidentally, the following short description of his appearance at that time, written by an anonymous lady who was present at the lecture in some unidentified memoir sent to me from Dayton, runs: "We were all excited about his coming, and there were some girls, I was not among them, who felt that simply to touch a thread of his jacket or to salvage a lock of his hair would bring a divine thrill unmatched in their girlhood dreams. Such was the power of the press and the sensational lure of his reputation. Dressed in velvet, with hair down to his shoulders, he stood on the stage twirling his gloves and languorously startled the citizens of Dayton with his views on America, on aesthetics. When I played the part I devised for myself in Dayton, I found that my glove-twirling skills were very limited and were cut. So this was what I arranged from that speech, and indeed other speeches, a few lines here and there. Ladies and gentlemen, I have come a very long way to be here tonight. I have traveled over vast sections of your country, a proceeding which has frequently elicited from me behavior of the utmost courage. One example will suffice. A month ago, whilst lecturing on artists of the Italian Renaissance in Denver, Colorado, I received a message that if I went on to Leadville, the harsher spirits there would be sure to shoot me or my traveling manager. I wrote and told them that nothing they could possibly do to my traveling manager would intimidate me in the least. And I went. My audience was composed of miners whose huge somber hats, red shirts and high boots reminded me forcibly of 17th century cavaliers. They are, I must tell you, the only well-dressed men I have so far seen in America. I read to them the most violent passages from the autobiography of Benvenuto Cellini, which proved so popular that they asked me why I had not brought him with me. I explained that Signor Cellini had been dead for some years, which produced the very natural demand, "Who shot him?" From there, I went to the Deep South, where I found among the more elderly inhabitants a melancholy tendency to date every event of importance to the late Civil War. "How beautiful the moon is tonight," I once remarked to a gentleman who was standing next to me. "Ah, yes," was his reply, "but you should have seen it before the war." From here, I journeyed all the way up to the Canadian border in order to contemplate Niagara Falls. I understand that every American bride is taken there on her honeymoon, and the sight of this stupendous waterfall must surely be one of the earliest, if not the keenest, disappointments of American married life. Now, at last, I find myself in the Midwest, and have been asked to speak most particularly on aesthetics. Last month, I was asked to do the same thing by the mayor of Griggsville, and I sent him a telegram assuring him that I would, if he would first change the name of his town. I am glad that your own town offers me no such insuperable difficulty. Dayton is a serious, practical name for what appears to me to be a serious and practical place. I have been asked on all sides for my overall impression of this part of America. I would say that I find it happily characterized by an unremitting vigor, and less happily, by an unrelenting plainness. To be frank, there is a distressing lack of spectacle in the public streets. There are no trappings to catch the eye, no pageants or gorgeous ceremonies. I have actually myself seen only two processions worthy of the name in the entire Middle West. One was a fire brigade preceded by the police. The other was the police preceded by a fire brigade. You may well point out that life does not consist of trappings. I must emphatically disagree. The fact is that it consists of almost nothing else. For this reason, one must invariably judge a book by its cover. Speaking of coverings, I had occasion a moment ago to refer to the clothes of the male population in present-day America. In my view, such garments are more than an offense, they are a crime. Every morning in the dressing rooms of your businessmen and politicians, the drab shakes ponderous hands with the doleful. As a result, art here is at a standstill. No painter can render such dreadful clothes on canvas, and no sculptor of sensibility can possibly cast them in bronze. I believe that the American frock coat has single-handedly put an end to imagery in the public sphere. Ladies and gentlemen, let me assure you, it is not a sign of moral failure to dress with charm. Let me offer you in parting one word of good cheer. The art of the future is unquestionably here in America, because future art will only be democratic art. No part of the world is richer in material than here. And the best art the world has seen has always been accomplished by republics. Only remember, a little sincerity is a dangerous thing, and a great deal of it can be fatal. That is really all I have to say on the subject. Should any of you wish to pursue it with me by communication, nothing could be simpler. I am traveling with two secretaries. One of them is solely employed to write my autograph. The other has a head of the most engaging brown hair and will send a lock of it to any young lady who writes for it, asking for mine. Sadly, but I suppose unavoidably, he is rapidly becoming bald. In summation, I would like to thank the United States of America for permitting me to behave within her borders as I have always behaved at home in England. In short, quite dreadfully. I thank you.